Okay, so the first readings are going to be on page 492, 493. And that's Esther 3, 1 to 10. And then 4, 1 to 17. So start with 3, 1 to 10, and then I'll move swiftly on to 1 to 17 without further ado. After these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, and advanced him and set his throne above all the officials who were with him. All the king's servants who were at the king's gate bowed down and paid homage to Haman, for the king had so commanded concerning him. But Mordecai did not bow down or pay homage. Then the king's servants who were at the king's gate said to Mordecai, "Why do you transgress the king's command?" And when they spoke to him day after day, and he would not listen to them, they told Haman, in order to see whether Mordecai's words would stand, for he told them that he was a Jew. And when Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow down or pay homage to him, Haman was filled with fury. But he disdained to lay his hands on Mordecai alone. So as they'd made known to him the people of Mordecai, Haman sought to destroy all of the Jews, the people of Mordecai throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus. In the first month, which is the month of Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, they cast cast lots before Haman day after day, and they cast it month after month till the 12th month, which is the month of Adar. Then Haman said to King Ahasuerus, "There is a certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from those of every other people, and they do not keep the king's laws, so that it is not to the king's profit to tolerate them. If it please the king, let it be decreed that they be destroyed, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who have charge of the king's business, that they may be put into the king's treasuries." So the king took his signet ring from his hand, and he gave it to Haman, the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, the enemy of the Jews. When Mordecai learned all that had been done, Mordecai tore his clothes and put on sackcloth and ashes, and went out into the midst of the city. And he cried out with a loud and bitter cry. He went up to the entrance of the king's gate, for no one was allowed to enter the king's gate clothed in sackcloth. And in every province, wherever the king's command and his decree reached, there was great mourning among the Jews, with fasting and weeping and lamenting, and many of them lay in sackcloth and ashes. When Esther's young women and her eunuchs came and told her, the queen was deeply distressed. She sent garments to clothe Mordecai so that he might take off his sackcloth, but he would not accept them. Then Esther called for Hathach, one of the king's eunuchs who had been appointed to attend her, and ordered him to go to Mordecai to learn what this was and why it was. Hathach went out to Mordecai in the open square of the city in front of the king's gate, and Mordecai told him all that had happened to him and the exact sum of money that Haman had promised to pay into the king's treasuries for the destruction of the Jews. Mordecai also gave him a copy of the written decree issued in Susa for their destruction, that he might show it to Esther and explain it to her and command her to go to the king to beg his favor and to plead with him on behalf of her people. And Hathach went and told Esther what Mordecai had said. Then Esther spoke to Hathach and commanded him to go to Mordecai and say, "All the king's servants and the people of the king's province know that if any man or woman goes into the king's inner court without being called, there is one law, to be put to death, except the one to whom the king holds out the golden scepter, so that he may live. But as for me, I've not been called to come into the king these 30 days. And they told Mordecai what Esther had said. Then Mordecai told them to reply to Esther, "Do not think to yourself that in the king's palace you will escape any more than all the other Jews. For if you keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this? Then Esther told them to reply to Mordecai, Go, gather all the Jews to be found in Susa, and hold a fast on my behalf, and do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day, and I and my young women will also fast as you do. Then I will go to the king, though it is against the law. And if I perish, I perish. Mordecai then went away and did everything as Esther had ordered him. The next section can be found on page 495 in your church Bibles, and it's Esther 6:14 to Esther 8:8. While they were talking with him, the king's eunuchs arrived and hurried to bring Haman to the feast that Esther had prepared. So the king and Haman went into the feast with Queen Esther. And on the second day, as they were drinking wine after the feast, the king again said to Esther, What is your wish, Queen Esther? It shall be granted you. And what is your request? Even to the half of my kingdom it shall be fulfilled. Then Queen Esther answered, If I have found favour in your sight, O king, and if it please the king, let my life be granted me for my wish, and my people for my request. For we have been sold, I and my people, to be destroyed and to be killed and to be annihilated. If we had been sold merely as slaves, men and women, I would have been silent, for our affliction is not to be compared with the loss of the king to the king. Then King Ahasuerus said to the Queen Esther, Who is he and where is he who's dared to say this? And Esther said, A foe and an enemy, this wicked Haman. Then Haman was terrified before the king and the queen. And the king arose in his wrath from the wine drinking and went into the palace garden. But Haman stayed to beg for his life from Queen Esther, for he saw that harm was determined against him by the king. And the king returned from the palace garden to the place where they were drinking wine, as Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was. And the king said, Will he even assault the queen in my presence, in my own house? As the word left the mouth of the king, they covered Haman's face. Then Harbona, one of the eunuchs in attendance on the king, said, Moreover, the gallows that Haman has prepared for Mordecai, whose word saved the king, is standing at Haman's house 50 cubits high. And the king said, Hang him on that. So they hanged Haman on the gallows that he prepared for Mordecai. Then the wrath of the king abated. On the day King Ahasuerus gave to Queen Esther the house of Haman, the enemy of the Jews, and Mordecai came before the king, for Esther had told what he was to her. And the king took off his signet ring, which he had taken from Haman, and gave it to Mordecai. And Esther set Mordecai over the house of Haman. Then Esther spoke again to the king. She fell at his feet and wept and pleaded with him to avert the evil plan of Haman the Agagite and the plot that he had devised against the Jews. When the king held out the golden scepter to Esther, Esther rose and stood before the king, and she said, If it please the king, and if I found favour in his sight, and if the thing seems right before the king, and I am pleasing in his eyes, let an order be written to revoke the letters devised by Haman the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, which he wrote to destroy the Jews who were in the provinces of the king. For how can I bear to see the calamity that's coming to my people? Or how can I bear to see the destruction of my kindred? Then King Ahasuerus said to Queen Esther and to Mordecai the Jew, Behold, I have given Esther the house of Haman, and they have hanged him on the gallows, because he intended to lay hands on the Jews. But you may write as you please with regard to the Jews, in the name of the king, and seal it with the king's ring. For an edict written in the name of the king and sealed with the king's ring cannot be revoked.
Thank you, Tina, for reading. Lots of tricky names. And then just to say, it's great to see everyone here. So it's been 7 months, as Marcus said, since I've been back. So it's great to be here again and just to see everyone's faces again. So if everyone could keep the talk outline in your service sheet handy to either take notes on or just to follow along during the talk as well. And if you could keep your Bibles open at Esther. So we'll be doing a whistle-stop tour through the whole of Esther. So if you keep it open and just try your best to follow along as we go through. The hiddenness of God can be a terrible thing for Christians. The Bible contains stories of great rescues and lots of miracles. But how do we face the problems in the world if we can't see that God is there? And harder still, how do we face the difficulties that are going on in our own lives? Maybe there are issues at work, at home, issues with our health, our relationships. You know, at some point in life, we all find ourselves wondering, where on earth is God in all of this? You know, why is this happening? Why isn't God doing something about it? You know, some of you here may very well be asking those questions today. But these aren't new questions that we're asking. They've been asked time and again by Christians over the ages. The question was certainly being asked when millions of people have been killed by their governments in Zimbabwe, in Rwanda, in Serbia, in the Holocaust of World War II. And the question would have been on the lips of every Jew in 474 BC when they faced a very real and a very certain annihilation. This is the story of Esther. What do you do as God's people when God seems hidden from you? In a nutshell, Esther is the story of how God rescues the Jews from annihilation. The evil Haman was set on destroying the Jews and was given permission by the king to do as he pleased. But through a series of events and through certain people, God delivered his people from a certain death. A queen was removed from power and replaced by a beautiful young woman. An official was able to hear about a plot to kill the king. And our heroine was willing to lay her life on the line for the life of her people. And in a tension-filled finale, justice wins out in the end. Esther is a great story. In and of itself, it's a great story, and I encourage everyone to have a read of it if you haven't done so before. But it's in the detail of Esther that we can learn so much about God and how he can work in our lives today. Now, Esther is set during a time when the Jews were living under the rule of the Persian king Ahasuerus. Ahasuerus is perhaps better known by his Greek name, Xerxes. He was a mighty ruler over a mighty empire. 127 provinces over what is nowadays Pakistan to the east, goes up to around where Bulgaria is, and south into Africa around Egypt and northern Sudan. This is the greatest empire that the world had ever known. And it's between the time of the books of Ezra and Nehemiah, when many Jews had returned to Jerusalem and to rebuild the city and the temple. But many Jews had also remained behind in Persia, so no longer in exile, but still not in their homeland. So without further delay, let's have a look now at chapters 1 to 3. That's all right, not verses 1 to 3 this week, chapters 1 to 3. So trust God, even when he seems hidden. Trust God, even when he seems hidden. Now, Esther is perhaps best known for its lack of any reference to God. No mention of God, the Lord, praying, sacrifices, the Passover, nor anything about living according to the law. In fact, the author seems to go out of his way to ensure that there is no obvious religious language. And although this seems a bit strange for an Old Testament book, it seems that maybe it's quite appropriate considering the world we live in today, one where we often seem unable to talk about God, where we don't see any miraculous signs, and where we often find it difficult to see what God is actually doing. And yet, we can so often still experience his presence, despite him seeming hidden to us. The book of Esther is one that encourages us to reflect on the story in light of what we know about God from other parts of the Bible, to build our worldview on Scripture. Maybe you could think of Esther as like a jigsaw puzzle. And as we walk through the story, we can see God piecing together all the pieces until we can see him clearly at work. And we can take confidence as we read through Esther. Things may be going on in our lives that we don't understand. Things may be going on in the world, and we just can't fathom a reason for it. We may be confused why God is letting some things happen. We may even be struggling to see that God is even present. But we can learn from the book of Esther that even though God may seem hidden from us, we can still trust him 100%. Now in chapter 1, a very drunken king one night after his six-month banquet decides to treat his wife as a prized possession. And the king commands Queen Vashti to come before him and all his drunken buddies to show her off. Then Queen Vashti refuses, and enraged at her refusal to obey the command of the king, his advisors recommend that he remove her as queen, and he does. And these turn of events, it's completely unfair for Vashti to be removed in such a way. However, her removal from the throne actually opens the door for our heroine to come into the story. As the king's servants suggest that the king hold an elaborate beauty pageant to find the next Miss Persia, the next queen. And so all of the beautiful young virgins in Persia are all rounded up and they're brought into the palace. Now, this whole event is grotesque and it's immoral. It's an affair in which hundreds, if not thousands, of young women are removed from the empire's marriage pool and they're all brought into a harem, and one by one they will all go in and they will have sex with the king, and the one that he likes the most will become the queen. It's completely immoral. However, it is through this beauty pageant that our hero and our heroine enter the story. Cue Mordecai and Esther. And Mordecai was most likely an official within the king's administration, given that he was inside the capital in Susa. But more importantly, if you look with me at chapter 2, verse 5, see, now there was a Jew in Susa, the citadel, whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, son of Shimei, son of Kish, a Benjaminite. Now, I'm not sure how many of you look up the genealogies when you read them in the Bible. I usually just skip them, but this time we're going to turn back to 1 Samuel chapter 9. So if you have a look back on page 278, so 1 Samuel 9, verses 1 and 2. So we'll skip son of the sonovs and sonovs. There was a man of Benjamin whose name was Kish, a Benjaminite, and he had a son whose name was Saul. So Mordecai, we see, is a descendant of Saul, the first king of Israel. So it seems perhaps that a rather large piece of the jigsaw puzzle has just been put into place. And we also meet Mordecai's cousin, Esther. Now, I'm sure she was a very intelligent and a very creative woman, but all we learn about her is that she had a beautiful figure and she was lovely to look at. So are these perhaps her most redeeming features? Possibly they were. Or just perhaps they were the most relevant features, given there was a beauty pageant going on at the time. And so Esther, being a beautiful young virgin, was taken into the custody of the king's eunuchs. Now, reflecting on what we know about God from other parts of the Bible, if we note the progression of events in chapter 2, in verses 9, 15, and 17, Esther won favor. In verse 9, firstly, she won favor with Haggai the eunuch. In verse 15, she won favor in the eyes of all who saw her. And finally, in verse 17, Esther won grace and favor in the king's sight. This winning favor language deliberately draws our attention to the hidden God having his hand in how things turn out. Exodus 34 shows us that when people find favor in God's sight, God will do awesome things. And so Esther became the new queen and is now on the throne. Yet another jigsaw piece has been put in. And at the end of chapter 2, Mordecai learned of a plot to kill the king. He notified the king via Esther, and the eunuchs implicated were executed. This was recorded in the Book of Chronicles, yet Mordecai wasn't rewarded for his service to the king. Now, Persian kings were noted for their generosity in rewarding those who helped the king or the kingdom. But unfortunately, here it seems Mordecai has been forgotten. Now, just keep this in the back of your minds for the moment, because we'll see later that maybe it wasn't so unfortunate. Now, in chapter 3, and note, in chapter 3, we're some 9 years after we started the book of Esther, our next character enters the story, Q. Haman, our villain. Now, we're given some genealogy for Haman as well in verse 1 of chapter 3. Haman the Agagite, son of Hammedatha. And we'll go back to 1 Samuel again now. 1 Samuel 15 this time on page 286. So 1 Samuel 15. If you look at verse 3. So this is God commanding Saul, "Now go and strike Amalek and devote to destruction all that they have. Do not spare them." And in verse 7, "And Saul defeated the Amalekites." And in verse 8, "And he took Agag, the king of the Amalekites, alive." Now in Exodus 17, we learn how the Amalekites were the first nation to oppose Israel after they left Egypt. And they became God's enemy, and God promised to blot them out. So in our story now, we have Mordecai descending from King Saul, who killed the Amalekites, except for King Agag. And we have Haman, descended from the same King Agag of the Amalekites, the enemies of God. So I'd say we've just connected a few significant pieces of the jigsaw together, and we're now starting to see a picture forming. And I think Mordecai knows the significance of their history, as he refuses to bow down to Haman, and he cannot bow down to an ancient enemy. And when Haman learns of this, if you look at verse 6 of what pure malice looks like. So Haman, "He disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone. So as they had made known to him the people of Mordecai, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews." Haman clearly knows his ancestry as well. He could very easily have had Mordecai killed for disobeying the law, and that would have been the end of it. But here we have not just a personality clash. We have a feud that has been simmering for centuries. And then Haman cast lots to determine when would be the most opportune time to destroy the Jews. And he then proceeded to get approval from the king to put his vile plan into action. And without a care in the world, the king just handed over his signet ring to Haman and told him just to do as he pleased. And so Haman issued a decree with instructions in verse 13 to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all Jews, young and old, women and children. It seems that the Jews have only one more year left to live. It doesn't look like God's in control. And we're left wondering, what on earth is going on? What now for God's people? How could God let this happen? If his people are destroyed, then what of God's promises to Abraham and to David? What do you do as God's people when God seems hidden from you? Well, when you look at all the pieces after they've been put into place, it starts to paint a different picture. God promised in Exodus 34 that he would blot out his enemies, the Amalekites. And we can see that what is being played out is this ancient feud. Israel versus Amalek, Saul versus Agag, Mordecai versus Haman. And although things are looking grim for the Jews right now, especially with Haman so close to the king, Mordecai is still an official in the administration, and Esther is still the queen. And God's people know that God keeps his promises. And so the Jews could be confident that although God seemed hidden, he was working behind the scenes, putting everything into place. And we too can have confidence as we read Esther. For the things going on in our lives that we don't understand, and for the things going on in the world that we just can't fathom a reason for. We may be confused why God is letting things happen and unsure of what to do next. But we can learn from the book of Esther that we can still trust God 100%, even though he may seem hidden from us, because we know that he is working behind the scenes in our lives. We can trust God if he seems hidden, for he has placed us where we are. And point two now, for he has placed us where we are. Well, chapters 4 to 8 are some of the most tension-filled chapters that you will read in the Bible. It's full of ups and downs, and you're left in a constant state of tension. And chapter 4 is a great reminder to us that we are where we are because God puts us there. We don't always know why, but he does. Chapter 4 begins with Mordecai hearing of all that had been done, and he tears his clothes, puts on sackcloth and ashes, and cries in a loud and bitter cry at the entrance to the king's gate. And we know from the likes of Job and elsewhere that this is typical Jewish mourning and crying out to God. And the Jews across the kingdom did the same. There was mourning and fasting, weeping and lamenting. They are not sitting back and just waiting for their destruction to come. As a people, they are crying out to God for action. But for all of their action, there seems to be a lack of action from God. No wonders, no mighty deeds, no encouragement or words from a prophet. Now Mordecai informs Esther through her eunuch everything that had happened and gave her a copy of the decree that was issued and even told her about the bribe that Haman used to influence the king. And he commanded her to go to the king and to beg his favor and to plead with him on behalf of her people. But she tries to excuse herself from any personal responsibility. What can she do? She can't just go and see the king if she hasn't been called. To do so could result in death, unless he happened to hold out the golden scepter. And besides, the king hadn't called on her for the last 30 days. Sorry, Mordecai, you'll have to find another way. But Mordecai replied in the bluntest of terms. If you look at his response in verses 13 and 14. Esther won't escape death just because she's in the palace. If she dies, it will either be at the hands of the king or at the hands of Haman. Deliverance will come for the Jews. If not through Esther, then by some other means. Mordecai doesn't know where this could be, but he is certain that God will rescue his people. And if it isn't through Esther, her life will certainly be forfeited if she chooses to remain quiet. And the second part of verse 14, I think, is a challenge not just for Esther, but for all of God's people. And who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this. And who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this. See, Mordecai has pieced together God's jigsaw. He knows this is exactly the reason why Esther has become queen. Everything in their lives has happened so that Esther would be queen. And she became queen for this very moment. God put her there so that through her, he could rescue his people. And so the question is left for Esther. Is this the reason why you are where you are? She must consider whether it is God's providence that she has become queen for this moment. And this is the same challenge that God's people must consider now. The difficulty Esther has, and the difficulty we have, is that there often is no easy answer to Mordecai's question. It is easy sometimes in hindsight to look back and see how God has been working in our lives. But at the time we're called to act, it may not always seem so clear. However, the way Mordecai's question is phrased, I believe, suggests that God has prepared us for such times, so that when we do face this question, we will be able to respond. See, God has been working to date in each of our lives. He has put us where we are. He has put people in our lives. He's given us good times and he's given us struggles, all for a purpose. We don't always know why God puts us in particular places and at particular times. And sometimes it can be painful to go through. But he does it for a purpose, his purpose. So remember that Esther was queen for 5 years before this moment. We are where we are because God puts us there. We can trust God, even if he seems hidden, for he has placed us where we are. So commit yourself to trusting God. So commit yourself to trusting God. Part of recognizing that God puts us where we are is also recognizing that situations arise in our lives that require us to act. At these times, it is not simply enough just to hope that God will make something happen. God uses people to bring about his purposes. This is the case all through the Bible, and it is still the case today. God has put each of us in our places of work, in our families, in our communities. He has put people in our lives to interact with. And we must commit ourselves to God's purposes in our lives now, so that when the time comes, we will be able to act. In verse 14 of chapter 4, Esther was left needing to make a difficult decision. Speaking out could result in her death. And this was a very real threat. It wasn't an idle warning. Is this moment worth risking her life for? Well, Mordecai's words obviously pressed home, just as Jesus' words to his disciples do in Matthew chapter 16. For whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. Those who step out in faith, even if they may lose their life now, will gain life eternally. We can do nothing without God, but God requires that we do not do nothing. And so Esther's response in verse 16 is the picture of resolute courage. Having been presented with the evidence, she is now stepping out in faith. And hopefully this gives each of us courage as well. She will go to the king, and if she perishes, then she perishes. Now she is the one taking charge, and she now orders Mordecai to arrange for all the Jews in Susa to fast for 3 days. And although not mentioned, we know that fasting means spending that time in prayer to God. Esther now knows why she is there, and she knows what it is that she has to do. But she also knows that she can do nothing without God. And this is often the tension in the Christian life: human responsibility alongside divine sovereignty. Things are now finally starting to look up again in the book of Esther. It seems that God is in control as Esther goes to see the king and she finds favor yet again. And just note that Esther didn't just go headlong barging into the king's chamber. After fasting and praying for 3 days, she prepared herself in all her royal finery. She is every bit the queen that first found favor 5 years ago. Esther has taken into account the situation. She has thought about it. She's prayed about it. And she's asked others to pray about it as well. This is how human responsibility and divine sovereignty work together in wisdom and prayer and partnership. This is what James in his letter would call the point at which faith and works come together. But Esther doesn't ask the king straight away to save her people. He offers her whatever she wants up to half his kingdom. And instead, she invites her husband to lunch along with Haman. At first, this is a bit incredulous. Why aren't you asking for deliverance? But I think it makes sense because we know as we read through Esther that Ahasuerus likes to eat and he likes to drink. All of his kingship is about eating and drinking. And he makes most of his decisions after he's been drinking. So perhaps it's quite wise of Esther to invite them to lunch. Only when the king again asks Esther what it is that she wants, she again doesn't take the opportunity. She invites the king and Haman to lunch again the next day. And she tells them that she will tell him her request if they come again. But what if they don't come again? We're left a bit incredulous again. But I think Esther, in building the tension, is all but guaranteeing that Ahasuerus is going to respond favorably to her request. The pieces seem to all finally be falling into place. Except in chapter 5, verse 13, Haman finds all this attention from the king and the queen, all the honor that he's getting, to be worth nothing, so long as he sees Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate. Whilst Esther and Mordecai are beginning to feel confident that things are starting to look up, Haman has a 22-meter stake built in front of his house so that he may impale Mordecai in a very public and a very painful killing. So in the Old Testament, when they refer to hanging or gallows, it most likely refers to being impaled on a stake. This was actually the forerunner to crucifixion. And if you're so inclined, you can go to the British Museum where you can see some depictions of what this looks like. And so we are left yet again in a state of tension. So God's people have acted in faith and in wisdom. They have labored with what wisdom was available to them and trusted God to work all things together for the good of his people according to his purpose. But that doesn't mean that we always receive what we want. We live in a world where others around us deny or ignore God in their actions, no matter what we do. And we don't always know exactly what God's purposes are in our lives. Esther is completely unaware of what Haman is planning. So she simply has to trust God and commit herself to his purposes, not knowing what will eventuate. And this is just the same for us today. We do what we can, acting in wisdom and trusting that God will bring about his purposes. We don't always know how things will turn out. We just have to trust God, even when he seems hidden from us and we don't understand his purposes for our lives. Now, committing ourselves to a particular action will look different for each of us. It may mean being known as a Christian in our workplace. It may mean standing up for a particular issue. You know, at the moment, it could be protecting marriage. It could be speaking out at a child's school, perhaps. Or maybe it is sharing the gospel with someone when that awkward opportunity arises and you would rather just shrink back and keep quiet. You know, maybe we will lose our job. Maybe we'll be ostracized. Maybe we'll even be mocked. Or maybe, just maybe, God will do amazing things through us when we commit ourselves to his purposes. It is only as we attempt things for God that we can expect great things from God, even if he does seem hidden. But in some countries, though, it could very well be like Esther, where speaking out could be a death sentence. The story of Esther, for many, is a chilling daily reality. If you receive updates from Open Doors or the Barnabas Fund, you will only be too aware of Christians being persecuted around the world. And so we should keep our Christian brothers in our prayers, that they would also be strong and commit themselves to trusting God. We can trust God, even if he seems hidden, for he has placed us where we are. So commit yourself to trusting God, for he will fulfill his plans for his people. for he will fulfill his plans for his people. So in the rest of the story, we read how God rescues his people. No miraculous signs and wonders, but a series of events brought about by God's people doing their bit and God doing his bit. We see that God is at work as we come to the climax of our story in chapter 6. So the king has a sleepless night. Literally, this translates as the king's sleep was taken from him. And he has the Chronicles read to him. I think we all know that there's no better way to help you get to sleep than to have someone read a history textbook. And, coincidentally, they read about how Mordecai saved the king. And the king, in his arrogance, obviously questions a guy when he doesn't read out about his generous reward. And you'll remember that's because there was no reward. And the king must remedy this. He can't be the king that is not generous to his subjects. And then, in the early hours of the morning, naturally, there are no officials in there because the king needs someone to tell him what to do next. And, rather fortunately, Haman has come in especially early that morning to get approval to kill Mordecai before lunch. And so proud Haman, thinking that the king could not possibly be pleased with anyone other than his good self, suggests the most elaborate and over-the-top reward. Dress him in the king's robes and parade him around the city in the highest of honor. Now, as you read through chapter 6, please do so with a huge smile on your face and just enjoy the irony of chapter 6. You can just imagine Haman's reaction when he suggested this reward and discovers that the reward wasn't meant for him after all. Rather, it was for Mordecai the Jew, his ancient enemy. Haman thought that he would be impaling Mordecai on a stake before lunch, but instead, he's left honoring him in front of the whole city as the one the king delights in. We can already see that God is starting to reverse things in favor for his people. Haman then quickly returned home to tell his family and his friends. No more boasting from Haman this time, but only mourning. And the cold truth from his friends in verse 13 of chapter 6. If Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of the Jewish people, you will not overcome him, but you will surely fall before him. God is most definitely at work. Proverbs 16 verse 18 tells us, pride goes before destruction. James chapter 4 verse 6 tells us that God opposes the proud. And perhaps there is an allusion here to Israel finally destroying Amalek, the ancient enemy of the Jews, just as God promised he would. In chapter 7, Esther reveals her identity as a Jew for the first time as she finally presents her request to the king at their second lunch. Her wish that the king grant her her life, her request, and that also of her people. She uses the words of Haman's decree as she pleads for the lives of her people who have been sold to be destroyed. Now, the king is completely ignorant of what is happening. In chapter 7, verse 5, who is he and where is he? Who has dared to do this? And in a beautifully played out scene, Esther can now accuse Haman directly. A foe, an enemy, this wicked Haman. Haman's fate is sealed. He has fallen before Mordecai, now he has fallen before Esther. And Haman is taken off, and he is impaled on the very stake that he had made for Mordecai. And his sons are also killed in chapter 9, thus ending the line of Agag forever. Amalek, the enemy of the Jews, at last defeated, just as God promised. Esther, Mordecai, and the Jews had done everything that they could do. But by themselves, this was not enough. It still needed God to do his bit for everything to work out. And these chapters bring to light the tension that we as Christians have to hold between human responsibility and divine sovereignty. It is as we commit ourselves to God's purposes that we can discern God's providence at work. It is as we commit ourselves to God's purposes that we can discern his providence at work. We labor in wisdom and we trust God to work all things together for the good of his people. And in chapters 8 and 9, Mordecai becomes effectively the new prime minister, as Ahasuerus once again hands over his signet ring and gives Mordecai permission to write as he pleases in the name of the king. And so Mordecai issues a decree to all the provinces, giving the Jews the right to defend themselves on Haman's day. And the rest of our story sees God bringing about great reversals. When Haman issued his decree, the city was thrown into confusion and the Jews mourned and fasted. But after Mordecai's decree, the city shouted and rejoiced, and the Jews rejoiced and feasted. And we see in verse 17 of chapter 8 that many even declared themselves as Jews. Now, this could just be that people supported their cause, but it seems that many people genuinely became Jewish, perhaps in religious awe, recognizing God's hand in things. And when decree day arrived, rather than destruction, the Jews gained mastery over all those who hated them. The Hebrew term used here is a passive one, highlighting that it wasn't the Jews themselves who overpowered their enemies, but it was God who did it for them. None could stand against them. And the people were glad, for they had been delivered by God from certain death. Mourning became celebrating. Fasting became feasting. And I'm happy about it. It seems that it's a good biblical principle for all celebrations to include plenty of food. So remember that next time you have us over for dinner. And they were to remember others by giving gifts and remembering the poor in what became the annual celebration of the Feast of Purim. And this still goes on today, this Feast of Purim. See, God's deliverance shouldn't be celebrated alone, but as a community. And as we read Esther, we are to remember the greatest reversal of all, that God has delivered us from a certain death, and he has given us life through the death and the resurrection of his Son, Jesus Christ. God had to rescue the Jews in Persia for his promises to Abraham and David to be fulfilled. God always fulfills his promises, and he did that most amazingly when he gave us new life through his Son. And we celebrate this at Christmas and at Easter and every time we share communion together, which we'll do together on Tuesday. Now, these are all joyful celebrations, for it was an amazing thing that God did in fulfilling his promises and delivering us. So let's remember this great reversal together as a church this Tuesday at the prayer supper and annual general meeting. And come early for dinner beforehand. We don't eat together simply because it's convenient, but because this is the pattern of celebrating God's deliverance of his people. Food, gladness, and remembrance. So I hope to see many of you there on Tuesday. And to wrap up the story, in the final chapter, life returns to normal. Mordecai is in a place of honor, engaging with the responsibilities towards the king, but also seeking the welfare of his people. God took a bad situation and he brought about his purposes for the good of his people. And we started off asking the question, what do you do as God's people when God seems hidden from you? Well, we trust God, even when he does seem hidden, for he has placed us where we are. So commit yourselves to trusting God, for he will fulfill his plans for his people. Amen.